On Life and Times on ABC Radio National this week, Paradise Lost. Hello, I'm Sue Clark. In early 1891, Queensland shearers went on strike. From February through until May, central Queensland seemed like it was on the brink of civil war. It was a bitter and often violent dispute that laid the foundations for the labour movement in Australia. One of the key figures during the strike was journalist and unionist William Lane. And over the next 3 weeks, we're going to take a look at what happened next in a social history program called Paradise Lost that was recorded and presented in August 1990 by Anne Whitehead. You see, Lane was also a utopian, and in 1892, he and around 500 others set sail for Paraguay in South America. Anne Whitehead also travelled there to talk to some of the descendants, including Margaret Riley, who grew up in Buckalden, where one of the largest strike camps was based. Here's episode one, A Rebel Flag.
The strike was in 1891. I can remember that because there were soldiers sent up from Brisbane to quell the strike, and they arrested the leaders of it, most of the leaders anyway, and they were sent down to Brisbane to St. Helena. I must have been about 9 or 10 at that time, because we left, I think we left Buckalden in 1893.
The Queensland Shearers' Strike of 1891 has been described as the closest Australia ever came to civil war. Margaret Riley was 105 years old at the time I interviewed her, and she died the following year in 1989. For many years, she'd probably been the only eyewitness of that strike left alive. But she also took part in the remarkable venture that grew like a phoenix out of its ashes, Australia's attempt at an idealistic socialist colony slap in the middle of South America. That venture, the Paraguay experiment, is the subject of this series. But the natural place to begin is with the episode that fired it, the shearers' strike, and at the place where the shearers made their strongest stand, the little railhead town of Buckalden. It was a traditional headquarters for shearers in Queensland's central west, and from there they'd go out to the different sheds. Margaret's father, Dennis Hoare, was a carrier, transporting the wool bales with his horse team. Travelling with him, young Margaret often got to see into a traditionally male preserve.
The shearing shed, it was just a place of activity when it started. When the whistle would blow, everything was working. The machines were going. That was when the machines were going. When they had the hand shears, the shearers would be bent down over sheep. They'd be men bringing up the sheep. They'd be pulling them in, and they'd be click, 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 clicking around the sheep. Dogs would be barking. The stockmen would be yelling. Everything would be going. Everything. It was just a hive of activity. The boys would be running with the tar pot, or they'd be running, picking up the fleece and taking it to the wool classer. The wool classer would be classing the wood, throwing the wool over some, go into the press. The pressmen would be working. Everything would be working. Everything. It was funny. I thought it was funny because I used to stand and watch them, and I thought, that's terrible. I used to think, what a terrible place. Oh, dear.
Until the strike, her father, Dennis Hoare, was making a living too, with the 16 massive Clydesdales that made up his two teams. After the drought and depression of 1890, the pastoralists made savings where they could. Horse teams could cart wool faster than the traditional bullock teams and were winning more of the work.
He used to take loading out for the stations from the railhead and bring the wool back. He'd go out and get his horses. He'd get a driver first. He'd see about getting a driver and a spare boy, and they'd muster up the horses and bring them in and yoke them up and go up to the railway and load up what they wanted to for the station, and then they'd take that out to Bowen Downs or Ondaroo or Vendex or some of those places like that. They were big stations. And Barcordon Downs was a very big station. The moneyed people didn't think anything much of the workers. The workers was nothing. They could live on nothing. And the stations, they'd get rations on the stations. Well, the rations was meat, and you had to bake your own bread, and sugar, and flour, and get a pound a week. And, you know, to keep a family on a pound a week, it was pretty bad.
So the new shearers' unions felt they had to fight the employers for any improvement in pay and conditions. But at the end of 1890, the squatters asked the shearers to take a cut in their rate, and that just wasn't on.
The strike was about the shearers. It was a shearers' strike, and about the conditions. And they wanted better conditions and a better pay for the sheep, for shearing the sheep. Because they used to get the men to shear for as little as possible. And their conditions weren't good. They wanted a better dining room and better sleeping quarters. They were very badly treated, I thought, and so my people thought. They were badly treated on the sheds. And that's what they were strike about. And it lasted quite a while because the owners of the stations wouldn't give in, and the shearers stood out.
Squatters had also combined into the Pastoralist Association. They demanded freedom of contract and began hiring non-union labour, bringing men up from the southern states with the full force of the government behind them. The union shearers still refused to accept the employers' terms and massed in 21 makeshift camps throughout central Queensland. The largest, at Barcaldine, had over 1,000 men. They determined to tough it out. The carriers' union went out on strike in solidarity, and Margaret's father, Dennis Hoare, became committed to the justice of the shearers' cause. And that meant his whole family had to become committed.
Well, I don't know what it is, but in those days he was better educated than a lot of others, a lot of people. A lot of people in those days couldn't even sign their name.
Did he read books about politics?
Oh, yes.
What sort of books?
Oh, history. He used to read history books and books on anything at all. Books on politics. He used to read the papers, any paper he could get. There was a champion paper there. James was the name, the people that run it. It had another name before the champion. I don't know whether it was the Western Champion, they called it. But that was the newspaper. And he always got that and read up the politics. He was very keen on the government, what the government said and what the government did and what they were doing.
He wasn't always keen on what they did, though, was he?
Oh, no, he wasn't. He wasn't, because until that strike in Bar Calden, there was only the one government. There was the Tory government, as we used to call it. The Tory government, the Liberal government. And there was, I don't know if there was even a Labour member until the strike was. Well, the strike then, that was the start of the Labour Party.
A new radical paper was being read, The Queensland Worker, edited by an eloquent young firebrand called William Lane. An Englishman, he'd spent 9 years in the United States, but had come to Australia, which he believed lacked the class divisions he'd deplored elsewhere. The strike now seemed the testing ground for his social theories. He wrote directly for the men in the strike camps and passionately endorsed their cause. In fact, he rather saw his role as defining it for them.
The strike in Queensland is not just about unionism, important as that is, but about democratic rights. Only 1 man in 10 among the shearers and pastoral workers has the right to vote.
Dennis Hoare thought that his daughter should understand about politics, and he'd take her to the meetings in the main street under a eucalypt, now dignified as the Tree of Knowledge and Barcaldine's number one tourist site.
There's a big gum tree grows near the railway station in Barcaldine, and mostly they'd get under there, under this big gum tree, at night, and they'd talk there, and they'd talk about what they wanted, why they were on strike, and things like that. We often used to go up and hear them, because my mother was very interested in it, my father was very interested in it, and we used to go up and sit around the railway station, around the goods shed, and they used to talk about what the conditions they wanted and why they were on strike, and they were going to stay on strike till they got it, if they could. Australia was nearer a revolution at that time than any time in its life. If the shearers could have got the arms, they'd have fought.
There was quite a bit of violence, wasn't there?
Yes, there was. They used to come down on the flat near the gully, and they'd have their fights there. They wouldn't fight up in the town because the police would stop it. But the police used to come down and stop it too.
This was between the shearers and the blackleg shearers, the scabs.
Yes. They tried to bring in shearers to do the shearing and leave the strikers out of it. They'd have an argument uptown and they'd come down and fight it out.
In William Lane's paper, The Worker, Henry Lawson published a poem supporting the shearers' cause.
So we must fly a rebel flag, as others did before us. And we must sing a rebel song and join in rebel chorus. We'll make the tyrants feel the sting of those that they would throttle. They needn't say the fault is ours if blood should stain the wattle.
The situation was becoming explosive. By March, there were 10,000 shearers and station hands out on strike in Queensland, with infantry and artillerymen, Gatling guns and heavy field pieces lined up against them. At the huge Barcaldine camp, they flew the blue flag of the rebel miners of Eureka and drilled to the rhythm of drum and fife.
Oh, it lasted nearly 12 months. And they were holding out, and I think that's why they sent the troops up. The train used to, from Rockhampton, used to come in there about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and the soldiers come on that, and they had their gear for camping, and they just camped just outside the town, and then the people, they thought, they didn't know what was going to happen. They just didn't know what was going to happen, to see all the redcoats. And anyway, it was fairly quiet. They never made any trouble. And they went out to their camp and camped outside. And they used to come into the town, parade the town, just to show themselves, just let the people see they were there. And they were there for a purpose.
But the shearers were armed, weren't they?
Well, I don't know if they were armed, but they intended to get arms. They intended to fight.
Where were they going to get arms from?
Well, I don't know. I don't know where they'd get arms from, unless they got from Rockhampton, because I don't know that many of them had much arms out there. I think my father had a rifle, I think, or a shotgun or something, but I don't think many of them had guns. There was only the shooters that would have guns, the kangaroo shooters.
I've heard that some of the shearers carved out of bits of wood pieces that would look like a rifle from a distance.
Oh, yes, they did. Waddies, they'd call them. They'd have waddies, and they'd fight with waddies, and they could fight with them, too. Another thing that I think they had there, too, was what they called Mullingar rifles. It was a stone in the toe of your sock, and they'd swing it around and hit you on the head with it and knock you out.
Why Mullingar?
Well, it was an Irish name, I think. But they said they'd fight for their rights, and they were hung out for a long time until the soldiers come up there and arrested the leaders.
Strike leaders, arrested in surprise raids, were transported for trial in Rockhampton in a high-security train. But they made a stopover in Barcaldine. A crowd of 1,000 were there at the railway station to meet them. They were held back by over 300 officers and the entire available military strength of the district. And incredibly, Dennis Hoare took 9-year-old Margaret into the crush to witness this dramatic event.
One of the men, the leaders of the strike, his name was Taylor, and he was up in Longreach, and the soldiers went up there and arrested him and brought him. I don't think there was a lock-up in Longreach at that time, and they brought him down to Barcaldine and locked him. They brought him down in chains because they were a bit frightened of what was going to happen in Barcaldine when they got off the train. I can remember we went up, my father went up to see him come down, brought down, because he knew Taylor, and we went up with him. And as he walked along, you could hear the chains rattling, leg chains, and his hands was chains. And I said to my father, what's that noise on him? And he said it was the chains.
There must have been a lot of anger at this man being tied up in chains.
Oh, yes, there was. They were very frightened that the people at Barcaldine had rushed the police. But anyway, nothing did happen. Because Taylor, he put his hands up. I can remember him putting his hands up like that, like to quieten the people, not to make trouble. And anyway, he was smiling at the people and that, and they kept quiet. They never made any trouble. They walked all around. Oh, there was crowds there to meet him, all the shearers and everything. And they walked with him all the way around to the lockup and saw him go into the lockup. And then he was tried the next day or something, and he got 3 years.
The 14 strike leaders were charged with conspiracy against the British Crown. an archaic statute that had been repealed in England. The trial in Rockhampton began ironically on May Day, in front of a judge who didn't even attempt to disguise his partisanship with the squatters. William Lane was there every day, reporting in disgust for the Worker.
The great conspiracy trial is drawing to its close, and tonight the prisoners will know their fate. Or rather, society will know its fate. It is society which is being tried, for justice here is a farce, and patriotism a mockery. Here in this courtroom, the class fight is being fought out. Here, squatter and labourer face one another, and the government and the judge and the whole judicial system chum in with the squatter, and one sees how hollow the law is and how useless it is to ever think of working together, capitalist and labourer, for the settlement of our social troubles.
The men were sentenced to 3 years' hard labour on St. Helena, a bleak prison island in Moreton Bay. William Lane sat down to write a novel, very fast, to raise funds for the imprisoned strike leaders. It portrayed capitalist society as hell on earth. He called it the working man's paradise. He had plans to write a sequel about a real paradise, a future socialist society in some remote part of the world. On the 20th of June at the Barcaldine camp, it was announced that there were simply no more funds to continue the struggle. The impetus had gone.
When the leaders left, the other men let it drop. It quietened the strike altogether. Well, it did quell the strike. And the men, they tried to get back to work. Well, the managers on the station wouldn't employ any men that was in the strike. They would rather have anybody else. And, of course, that caused a lot of trouble. They reckon they were scabs. They went out and took their jobs from them. And a lot of them lost their job. My father did. He lost his job. About that time, they were breaking up the big stations. And a lot of people went in for land. And that's how they got out of it. But my father wasn't one for land. He didn't. He said he had enough of it in Victoria. He said with the floods and the bushfires and one thing or the other, he had quite enough on land, but he didn't want it.
Despite the emergence of a new Labour Party after the defeat of the strike, William Lane insisted in the pages of The Worker that Australia had had it, too contaminated by the evils of the old world. Instead, he appealed to the Bushmen, their hopes crushed at Barcaldine, to consider a more daring cooperative venture much further afield. Lane had formed the New Australia Cooperative Settlement Association and had sent agents to South America to look for land. In 1892, the government of Paraguay, in the very heartland of the continent, made them a magnificent offer. 40 square leagues, or about 185,000 acres, of fertile, well-watered land. The Paraguay government was anxious to encourage immigration because the country had suffered staggering losses, 90% of its manhood, in a war only 20 years earlier. As a result of the strike, there were many disillusioned people in Queensland, many on blacklists, still unemployed, some still living in squalor in the old strike camps. They responded eagerly to Lane's vision. Dennis Hoare, Margaret's father, was one of those who listened.
He was out of work, but I don't know what he did. He got a job somewhere for a while, and then he heard of this blooming Paraguay, and he thought he'd go there.
How do you think he heard of it?
Well, I don't know whether he heard about it through the paper. He used to get the Worker. And whether he heard about it through that, Lane and a few others in Sydney formed this idea about Paraguay and got the people, what people they could, to go. And I think Lane was a editor or something of the Worker. And he always got the work. And whether it was through that, I think it was through that. And he thought he'd go. Because I think he was about the only one from Barcaldine that went. He came home one day and he said to me, Mother, about this William Lane. He was, I don't know if William Lane was in Queensland or not. I don't know. He might have been. But he might have come to Queensland, and that's how my father got in touch with him. And he said they were forming a settlement in Paraguay, and he was thinking of going there. And my mother didn't want to go. She wasn't keen on going at all. But anyway, of course, what he said was law. She said she wasn't very keen about it. She said, I don't think it'll work. He said, oh, it'll work all right. He said, because the people, there's a lot of people going. He said, and I'd like to go. So anyway, he went. My mother went with him. And seven kids went with him. So I don't know how he got there with them, but he got there.
Margaret Riley. And on ABC Radio National's Life and Times, you're listening to Paradise Lost, which was recorded and presented by Anne Whitehead in August of 1990. And Freedom on the Wallaby was the Henry Lawson poem which was written as a comment on the strike and was published by William Lane in The Worker on the 16th of May 1891. The rebel flag was the Eureka flag. And the Tree of Knowledge in Barcaldine was poisoned and died in 2006, and a memorial on the site was opened in May of this year. So the strike was now over, and the promise of a utopian paradise had captivated Margaret's father, Dennis Hoare. And he made the decision to take his wife and seven children on an epic journey by sailing ship, riverboat, steam train and bullock cart to a camp in the South American jungle. In episode 2, New Australia Bound, Margaret recounts that journey.
So we had to go down to Rockhampton and we got a boat, a ship there, and we went to Sydney. And then we went from Sydney, we went to Adelaide and we got on the Royal Tower and we went across to America.
In 1893, a group of Australian Pilgrim Fathers, and they were mostly men, set off in the sailing ship Royal Tower, a kind of reverse Mayflower into the unknown, with only their faith to support them. Their leader, William Lane, had faith in socialism. The bushmen who followed him believed in mateship, and John Lane took his family because he had faith in his brother William. But according to John's son Eric, they met a lot of opposition before their departure from Australia.
The government did everything in its power to prove the Royal Tower unseaworthy. I don't blame the government. My opinion is because they thought this was a harebrained scheme and they didn't want the extra expense of bringing back Australian citizens. But they did everything in its power to block it. But the thing that broke the settlers' hearts and made them more determined than ever to get away was when the labour unions themselves boycotted them. That's what hurt the most. The go-slow tactics of the painters' union, etc., or whatever union it was.
Even magazines sympathetic to the labour movement, like the Bulletin, mocked and satirised the whole venture.
On the assumption that life among wild oranges and Yaba Mate scrub has capabilities it does not offer in Australia, one of the most feather-headed expeditions ever conceived since Ponce de Leon started out to find the Fountain of Eternal Youth, or Sir Galahad pursued the Holy Grail, is about to set forth.
But the New Australia pioneers weren't about to be deterred.
over there in Paraguay by a bushman. They say there's Injuns whooping round for new Australian blood, musketeers big as kangaroos and fevers in the mud, and crocodiles and horrid wars, at least the papers say. But there's no Australian squatters over there in Paraguay.
The Royal Tar sailed on July the 16th, 1893. Most women and children had to wait for its second voyage. The Royal Tar raised its sails and moved down the harbour to the strains of Auld Lang Syne. The young poet Mary Gilmore, who later joined them in Paraguay, described the scene.
The deck was crowded. Ringing cheers sounded all along the waterfront. The banner carried the motto, "Each for all and all for each." Aloft, in one of the lifeboats, stood William Lane, his pale face worn with work and worry, aglow with a sweet, unselfish joy. The dream of 4 years was fulfilling itself. The crowd was eager to believe that the new voyage of discovery would bring gladness and a renewed hope in mankind's future. 3 cheers were given for freedom, Lane, and Paraguay. As the vessel sailed from sight, there was not an eye that did not glisten.
In Queensland, the teamster Dennis Hoare, out of work and disillusioned after the failure of the shearers' strike, decided to go on the Tar's second voyage with his wife and children.
It must have been a big decision for him to make, because there were 7 of us, and the mother, and a young baby. He was only quite... He was about 3 months old when we left Bar Calden. And she had him, she was feeding him herself. And, you know, it was a big decision for him to make, with 7 children to go.
Now, what did your mother think of that decision?
She thought it wouldn't work. And she told my father it wouldn't work. But he said, oh, well, he said, you can give it a chance. So, of course, if he said, what he said was law with her, with my mother. And I really don't know how she travelled around like she did from place to place with those 7 youngsters. You know, it must have been a trial.
His daughter, Margaret Riley, 105 when I interviewed her, recalled this crucial turning point in their lives.
Every adult was supposed to put in £60. And whether he put in £60 for himself and my mother, I don't know. But anyway, he put in what money... He said, they said you had to put in whatever money you had or whatever money you could. He sold the house we had. We had an acre of ground, and it was a big piece of ground, a good piece of ground, and it was in a good position. And he sold that, and he had the money for that. And he sold his teams and his horses and his saddle horses and his draft horses. And he must have had a bit of money. And whether he put it all in or not, I don't know. But I know my mother had a few sovereigns and she kept them. She said she wasn't going to put it in because she didn't know how it was going to work. And she said she might want it, which she did later on. And so anyway, everyone had to do that. They bought this ship in Sydney, the Royal Tar. It was an old cargo ship. And When they bought it, they fitted it out to take passengers. And when we went down to Sydney, they weren't sure whether they could take the women and children. So the men all went to Adelaide, and we were all left in Sydney. We had Christmas in Sydney, and I think we had New Year. But anyway, when they fitted out the ship, they found that there was room for the women and children. So they sent for the women and children. And we had to go by train from Sydney to Adelaide. And when we got to Albury, you see that the gauge of the railway changed there to Melbourne. And we got there early in the morning. And, of course, we were all laying about to sleep. And my mother looked out the window, and my father had got a big wooden grey box made. And everything that wasn't wanted for the trip was packed into that box. Her sewing machine, it was a hand sewing machine, a machine and different things, blankets, sheets, pillow slips, and all things like that. A lot of our clothes that we didn't want was packed into that box. And she looked out the window when we got to this station, and she saw them unloading our big box. And she said, oh, she said, they're taking our big grey box off. It was always called the grey box. She said, oh, they're taking our big grey box off. She said, I'll go down and see what they're doing. So she went down to see what they were taking the box off for. And they said we had to change trains. Then there was a scruffle. We were all roused up. Some of us couldn't find our boots and some couldn't find their hats. And such a scruffle there was to get out of the train in time. So anyway, we got on to another train and got to Adelaide. And when we got to Adelaide, we were shunted off down to the wharf.
Of the 200 passengers on the second voyage of the bark-rigged sailing ship Royal Tar, 132 were men, and there were 19 wives and the rest children. As they boarded, they got a cable saying there was trouble over at the Paraguay colony. But they weren't prepared to have their fervour dampened and ignored it.
Royal Tar was out at sea, and we had to load into small rowing boats to go out to the ship. I can remember it. It was a scruffle. You know, so many women and so many youngsters. And they were throwing youngsters up to the men. They were standing up on the ship and they were throwing kids up to them, you know. They'd catch them. Oh, it was real funny. And anyway, my father was there and he caught me. I can remember him catching me and putting me on the deck. He said, now you stop there. And I thought, well, this is a funny thing. How are we going to get on at all? And anyway, we got on. Then he took us all down to our cabin. We had a big cabin because there were 7 children and the mother and father, and we had rather a big cabin. But anyway, we all got settled in. And I don't know, I think it was early in January we left Adelaide. I can't quite remember, because I got seasick. The movement of the ship made me seasick. And my mother got seasick, and she had a baby about 4 months old. There was a nurse on board, and she took the baby and looked after the baby, and then she'd bring him to my mother to feed him when he wanted a feed. And we went down, I think, into the Antarctic, because we went down lower than New Zealand to go round Cape Horn. And I know we saw icebergs in the distance. We weren't near them because they didn't know how much ice was under the water, and they wouldn't go near them. The captain wouldn't go near them. So we could see them in the distance, and the waves splashing up over them. And anyway, we got around Cape Horn safely. We were all one day going up and down the coast. We could see the land, but we were up and down. We'd go so far, we'd go back. And we'd go so far and go back, waiting for the wind. See, he wouldn't use the engines going around Cape Horn. He wanted to sail round. And he must have been a good captain, because he knew the sea, he knew the winds and everything. So anyway, it was in the afternoon that the wind changed. And as soon as the wind changed, the sailors rushed out, up the mast, and undone the sails, and set the sails, and we sailed around in great style. It was quite good, and it wasn't rough. Not that I didn't get sick anyway, and I got sick as soon as it was rough.
So there were quite a few rough days during the trip.
Yes, it was. Some of the way was terribly rough, and the ship used to roll. You know, you'd be sitting at the dining room table. They had a ledge around the table to hold the dishes. And you'd be sitting at the table, and the ship would roll, and you'd go back, and the dishes would all come your way, and then they'd go back over the other, then they'd run the other way. And you didn't know whether you had your dinner or what. It was terrible sometimes.
What was the food like on board?
Oh, it was very good. Very good. We used, every Sunday we'd get a plum pudding, roast meat, and there'd be roast and some of the meat they'd have, corn meat, I think. And any other dinner we'd get rice or tapioca or a steam pudding. They used to have make-up concerts. There was a chap on board, he was a Scotsman, near the bagpipe. And dancing, they used to have dancing. I learned to dance on the ship. And then they had a concertina, and they used to play that. And then we'd have sing songs, and then we'd make up a bit of a concert, and anyone that could sing or recite or do anything, he'd do it. There was a girl there, and I just forget what her name was, but she was much older than we were. And she had a very good voice. She used to sing quite a lot. Different songs. She'd sing Worsley Matilda, and she used to sing Annie Laurie, and a lot of those old songs. And she'd sing. And yes, they had amused themselves, cards. I learned to play cards on the ship. And we'd play Casino, or Old Maid, or Euchre, or something like that. They used to amuse themselves quite well. They had to, because they were so long on the ship. We were from January till March on the ship. We saw whales. They used to come up and squirt the water up in the air and then dive down again. And they'd come up and you could see the whole whale in the water. And you'd see those porpoises. We used to sit at the nose of the ship and watch the porpoises going by. And we went up the coast of South America to Montevideo. We pulled into Montevideo, and the captain didn't have his papers right or something. There was no sickness on board, but we were quarantined for 7 days. We had to go out in the bay. No ship was allowed to come near us, and they had to fly the yellow flag, and we were out there for 7 days, and then the captain had all his papers ready, and when we went in, it was quite all right. And we had to wait there for a riverboat to take us up the Rio de la Plata. That was a lovely trip up the river. It was a paddle boat. There was big paddles each side of it, and they used to paddle the water. It was a steamship. Big paddles. It was glassed in. They were glassed in. Then no water used to come on the deck, and we had a deck cabin right up on the deck near the paddles. And these big paddles used to paddle the water. And one night we got stuck on a sandbank, and we were stuck there till nearly midday the next day. They thought everybody'd have to disembark to get the ship off. But anyway, I think the tide lifted us off when the tide came into the river. It was a big river. The nights were lovely. The scrub was all lit up with fireflies and fire beetles. I used to sit on the deck and look at the out to, on the land and see these fireflies. You'd see them flying in and out, you know. It was really lovely. And it was very good sailing. Very good sailing. Anyway, we paddled our way up to Asuncion.
In 1982, I made my first journey to Paraguay. A descendant of the colonists, William Wood, was with me at the wharf at Asuncion, a noisy, colourful place on the edge of the wide river. Bill Wood also took me to the National Theatre, where the colonists were first billeted by the government. Here, soldiers passed the Australian girls peeled oranges through the windows on the ends of their swords.
In 1893, when the Royal Tower people arrived in Asuncion, the Paraguayan government put this National Theatre at their disposal till they got the train to go to New Australia.
We got on the train in the morning. They saw that the grey box was on board, and the train, it was overloaded with all our gear and all the passengers and everything, and it just crept out of the station. You could get out and walk alongside it. And we didn't think we'd ever get to the next station. We didn't think we'd ever get. Anyway, they'd shunt back, and then they'd go again. The upgrade, they used to just crawl up an upgrade, and the oranges, you'd see orange trees at the side of the road or a little distance from the road. We'd jump out of the train and run across and grab some oranges and run back to and catch the train. When the driver, he'd see us coming, he'd put on a bit of a spurt and send the train along, and we'd have to run after it. Oh, it was a trip. It was a trip, right enough. The rail terminus was at Cavalera. I think that was the name. Cavalera or something. I think it means the gentleman. We got off the train there and we had a meal. Somebody gave us a meal. There were some men there to meet us from the settlement. And they gave us a meal. It was only just a light meal. And my mother was very anxious. She liked her tea, and she was very anxious for it. And she enjoyed it. We did too. And then the bullock drays came, carretas. And they had four bullocks. Not bullocks, they were really bulls. They were four of them yoked up in these wagons. And we loaded into that our goods and everything, or whatever goods they could take in with you. And we started on the road. We were about a week going up on the road, going to the settlement. And there was a big Monty scrub we had to go through before we came to the settlement. And the natives wanted to get through that scrub before nightfall. But anyway, they could. It was about 3 miles long because it divided the main settlement from the other settlements. And they wanted to get out of that, Monty, before dark.
They were frightened of wild animals?
Yes, I think they were. And the jaguar was there. Although, I don't know if the jaguar would tackle a person. I'm not sure about that. But it would tackle a calf. But anyway, they unharnessed the bullocks and tied them up to the carettas. They wouldn't let them loose. Well, see, they'd get lost. And they wouldn't let them loose. And they built fires. And the men, the drivers, sat around the fires. And the men, most of the men, sat around the fires. And the women and the children slept in the carettas. And then, soon as daybreak, they were all up, put the fires out, and yoked up and got out of the Monte. When we got out, well out of the Monte, they unharnessed the bullocks, set them free, took them to water, and let them free and let them have a feed. The natives, they lay down and had a sleep, and we could if we wanted to. Some of the men did, because they were up all night sitting around the fires with the natives. And anyway, they had their sleep, and they stayed there till nearly midday. And then they yoked up and went a bit further on. And we were out on the plain then, so that was all right. They weren't frightened. But I think they were frightened because they kept the fires going, the wild beasts. Because, anything could happen in those Montes. Anything at all could happen. They were thick with undergrowth and the vines that used to come down from the trees. And the trees, you couldn't see daylight through the trees. They were that thick.
Now, what did you think you were going to?
Oh, I don't know what we thought. We thought we were going into the wilds, which we did do.
You've been listening to Paradise Lost, which was recorded and presented by Anne Whitehead in 1990. And that was episode 1, A Rebel Flag, and 2, New Australia Bound. And Dame Mary Gilmore, who you can see on the $10 note that was issued in 1993, did indeed sail to Paraguay. She arrived in January 1896 and married William Gilmore there the following year. And Anne Whitehead's book, Paradise Mislaid, In Search of the Australian Tribe of Paraguay, won the New South Wales Premier's Australian History Prize in 1998. And you know where to go to find more details on it, hear this program again, or to leave a comment. abc.net.au/rn/lifeandtimes. Next week, Episode 3, The Working Man's Paradise, and 4, Virgin Ground, on Paradise Lost, on Life and Times, here on ABC Radio National.